America is designed around allowing the super wealthy elite to do whatever the f*** they want. Can I curse on this?
Well, you can now.
Yeah.
But when it comes to American militarism,
yeah,
that's something I can't cross.
It's social conditioning. It's propaganda. Trump has experienced historic lows in his approval ratings, and yet the Democrats are still an imaginably unpopular party.
People don't talk about the fact that U.S. forces train with Israeli forces.
Israel is an extension of American empire. Israel is not a separate entity from the United States of America, no matter how much either camp tries to present it as the case.
Why'd you stop doing Piers Morgan? Is it because he does your uncle dirty on these thumbnails?
Yeah, I'm pro-Israel now. I'm Israel Chai. Yeah.
Oh my God, what was my question?
Yeah.
All right, do you need me to do a clap or anything? Cool, here's a clap. Hassan Piker, welcome to Real Talk.
Very excited to be here.
I'm so excited to have you. This has been a long time coming. I've been in LA, came back empty-handed, and we were meeting here in Doha.
Yeah, it was a kismet. This is where it was supposed to happen.
Exactly. Look, I'm getting thrown off a little bit because I'm not used. I'm getting a little bit of imposter syndrome. I'm not used to having such a big set for Real Talk. It's usually a pretty basic setup. But there's like an umbrella with a light bulb, and I don't even know what it is.
This is a very professional crew you got.
They're very professional. They're very professional.
There's like four people in this room right now, just off camera, monitoring the situation. It's pretty crazy. Yeah, the Middle East eyes, they've leveled up in the production quality.
You know what? This is gonna land so funny when the guys in London hear this. It's gonna land so funny.
I like it.
Because we go through a lot in London. Shout out to Hassan, the director. You know, I was watching you last night. You were up quite late doing the stream, or your stream, I should say. And I was getting nervous because it was like past 2 a.m. and I knew we had the interview today in the morning.
Yeah.
Because I was about to get ready to go to sleep, but you were still going. Like I think you were munching on something. You're talking about Epstein, but. Part of me just wanted to be like, do I write in the comments and be like, bro, like, are you going to be up in time tomorrow?
Yeah, no, I woke
but
up.
Here you are.
I went to bed at 3 last night, like 3:30. I woke up at 8. I worked out. I had breakfast with my dad, had some coffee, worked out,
amazing.
Showered. Respect. I was ready to go.
Respect.
This is like my days when I travel are definitely a little bit more slammed, a little bit more packed than they are when I'm at home. But because I'm so used to also waking up super early at home, working out, and then live streaming for 8 hours. Yeah. When I'm traveling, if I live stream for like 4 hours to 6 hours, which is what I've been doing 6 hours instead, late into the night, that actually gives me a lot more room for doing, you know, interviews and things like that. So I'm used to having like this crazy schedule anyway.
Yeah.
So sometimes when I'm traveling and I'm doing all this, all these media hits and interviews while also simultaneously doing my stream, because I've lowered the hours I'm streaming, it's much easier for me to do.
Mm. You know, just you saying 8 hours, excuse me, you saying 8 hours and 6 hours, that's going way over my head. I'm like, you know, after a 90-minute interview, I have literally nothing more to say. How do you keep going for that long? I know you get asked about it all the time.
I love yapping, man. I love yapping. I got a lot to say.
That's incredible, though.
I got a lot
Six
to say.
6 hours. And that's the shortened version.
Yeah. Yeah, the abbreviated version of my regular stream. But I feel like there's a lot of issues that need to be addressed. And there's a lot of people that are invested in understanding the world. And so someone's got to do it. Mm. And I'll be that guy. I'm stubborn enough to keep trucking.
Mm. How's the Gulf treating you? We met here at the Web Summit.
Yeah, the people are wonderful.
Qatar.
I mean, Qatar is not my speed. I will admit that. It's I feel like the Gulf states have a very Miami vibe to them, and I don't like Miami at all. Like, no disrespect. I do love the diversity here, though.
Mm-hmm.
There are people from every different part of this region that congregate in Qatar, and I think that's beautiful. I haven't heard so much Turkish being spoken randomly. That just like throws me off a little bit. Yeah, everybody speaks a little bit of Turkish here, which is crazy. So that's been really cool, and the people are so nice. They're so inviting in general. Yeah, they're true. So welcoming.
It's an Arab trait.
Yeah,
it's a
for sure.
Traditional Arab trait.
Yeah, everyone wants to give whatever they have.
That's very true.
And that's been beautiful to see. But I haven't really had too much time to actually go and visit Doha. I've just been at the Web Summit for the most part, and just doing like back-to-back, you know, press hits over and over again. So I haven't really, you know, taking photos with fans and stuff like that. That's all I've been doing. And then coming back to the hotel room and just live streaming. So hopefully I'll be able to see Doha a little bit after this interview.
No, hopefully you do. Hopefully you get more out of it. Look, this interview is just, there's no formula here. It's just going to shift back and forth between the political question and then maybe a personal question. And we'll ride the wave together. So last night when I was watching you, you were talking about Epstein, right? You were talking about the Epstein files. That's obviously a story that's getting a lot of traction right now. I guess the first question that comes to mind about that is, do you feel like all these powerful people that are named in these files, whether business or political or, you know, entertainment, like, do you think they'll be prosecuted, or has that moment kind of passed?
Well, I think that a lot of very powerful people have their reputations tarnished in general. But in the United States of America, no, I don't think any powerful people of worth will actually receive even a fraction of the punishment that they deserve.
Why do you think that is?
Because America is designed around allowing the super wealthy elite to do whatever the fuck they want. Can I curse on this?
Well, you can now.
Yeah. Okay. All
right. No, you can't curse.
But that's what it is. That's what America's all about. It's the purest distillation of capitalism, where the pedophilic global elite can get together and do heinous crimes against humanity, while they very openly talk about their grand design for the world, talking about coups that they're facilitating around the world, talking about selling Israeli surveillance technology to other countries.
Yeah.
Like it's this incredible revelation about the way that people like myself see the world, to see this confirmation in broad daylight, and then to also recognize that the American government is probably not going to do anything about it because this is how they have operated in perpetuity. Is, hopefully an enlightening moment for a lot of people who are oblivious to this reality.
Yeah. Do you think this is what it is? It's just more of a revelation more than anything else, and the tarnishing of people's reputations and all that.
Yeah. I mean, it's vindication for someone like myself. I mean, I've been talking about the dollar hegemony backed by a global pedophilic cabal of elites, for many, many years. And it's the purest distillation of class war that you see in these supposedly private back and forth conversations that are taking place, where watching that unfold has been vindicating, and also the lack of interest from the American government in terms of prosecution has also been another unfortunate moment of vindication as well. Having said that, it has been interesting to observe European allies actually go after people that are Jeffrey Epstein affiliated. I believe there was something going on in Slovakia where a Jeffrey Epstein affiliate is actually probably going to lose their position of power. Mm. Same with Lord Mendelssohn potentially as well in the UK.
In the UK.
Whereas,
I think he had to resign, I believe.
In the United States of America, the only punishment that has been dished out is to a charlatan alternative health person, Peter Attia, I believe his name is, that had like a new Barry Weiss gig at CBS News.
Yes, yeah.
And now, CBS is like, you can't do this anymore because there's information out there where you were corresponding with Jeffrey Epstein, talking about heinous things that he was doing, and celebrating the heinous things that Jeffrey Epstein was doing, including but not limited to actually. Not going to the hospital for his newborn child, who was actually experiencing this tremendous health complication. And the reason for why he didn't actually go to the hospital was because he was hanging out with Jeffrey Epstein in New York. Just a horrible, monstrous person. And yet Barry Weiss was still behind closed doors trying to defend him, trying to make sure that he doesn't lose his job, claiming we can't cave to the woke mob. The woke mob is taking away our bravest pedophiles.
Aren't you a member of the woke mob though?
Yeah, I mean, I am. I am a member of. I'm doing woke Sharia. I am the woke Ayatollah, as I like to say, and you know, we're bringing woke back in a big way.
Listen, I wanna come back to Barry Weiss and CBS in a bit. I'll It'll be interesting to see how I squeeze that back in, because I just going all over the place. But back to your stream, you also had Bilal Khalid on, who's a Palestinian photojournalist, right, from Gaza.
Yeah.
And he was someone that was in Gaza during the onset of the genocide. And he managed to escape, or he managed to leave, I think a year or so later. He's a good friend of mine. But I wanted to ask you, why is it now still important for you to keep centering Palestinian voices?
Well, because the atrocities are ongoing.
Yeah.
A big part of the reason why there was this fake ceasefire that was established was because even Donald Trump started recognizing that the pressure was mounting too much on not only the American government, but also the European partners as well. In the Western world, there were far too many demonstrations, general strikes taking place in places like Italy. And it got to a point where it was undeniable that Israel was committing a genocide, and that it was also equally undeniable that the European liberal democracies, these bastions of freedom and human rights, these governments that are supposed to uphold the international rule-based order, were not actually committed to upholding that at all, and were completely in line with the continuation of Israel's genocide of the Palestinians. And so they started offering fake concessions to the crowd in order to satiate their needs, in order to silence the protests that were taking place. First, they tried to stamp it out. They made it illegal in some ways, like in the UK, where Palestine Action was prescribed as a terrorist organization, as though if you had a placard that said, "I support Palestine Action," it was the equivalent in the UK of waving an ISIS flag, right?
I mean, Greta Thunberg got arrested for something similar in London.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it's ridiculous. It's comical if it wasn't so horrifying to watch unfold. But this juxtaposition, this inconsistency, this contradiction was so glaringly obvious. The notion that European nation states are supposed to be upholders of liberal values, humanitarian values around the globe, and then they were punishing their own citizens for speaking out against these crimes against humanity that the very same European countries were actually involved in. They decided they have to do something about it. So what ended up happening was this fake ceasefire, where Israel continues to kill Palestinians every single day, including just this past weekend, where they killed 32 Palestinians, many of them, majority of them children, once again. So the atrocities are still continuing, even though the media focus has shifted, even though the public's focus has shifted away from these atrocities. So I try to still get people to be invested and get people to be interested in what's going on there, and to continue the pressure campaign to the best of my ability.
You see it like as a responsibility towards the content you deliver?
I see it as a responsibility.
Or a partial responsibility.
I see it as a personal responsibility as a human being. Okay. I am fortunate enough to have this platform, so of course I will use it to speak truth to power. But having said that, even if I did not have this, I would try to organize to the best of my ability, regardless. As a human being, I find genocide to be unconscionable, the crime of all crimes, the worst crime that someone can commit. And as an anti-fascist, as someone who's an anti-Zionist, as someone who is anti-genocide, of course, I'm going to do everything I possibly can to organize, to try to penalize the government that I'm a part of, the government that I actually pay taxes to, because at the end of the day, I feel like I am morally culpable as well in these atrocities. I can't stand idly by and stand aside and allow these things to continue without trying to push back to the best of my ability.
Mm. I want to explore a bit, I guess, your background and your upbringing and all that, but you were born in New Jersey. You grew up in Turkey.
Yeah.
I want to try to understand how that experience shaped you, I guess, politically today, because you do have a very interesting, experience here, in the sense of you grew up in a part of the world that has been, that has seen the negative consequences of the actions of U.S. hegemony, let's say.
Yes.
And then you went back to the U.S. where it's not seen the same way. It's quite a blind spot. People actually may view it as the viewpoint that the U.S. is the world's police and it's that is some and somehow a force for good.
Yeah.
So having these two perspectives or I guess being in these two places, how did it shape you? How did it shape your views?
I think my upbringing in Turkey is definitely a big part of the reason why I am an anti-imperialist. And even though my social conditioning first and foremost in Turkey did not factor into my analysis about even Turkey's own actions in the region as well that are destabilizing at the behest of the United States, I understood even my own government's actions, Turkish government's actions, because I was able to apply that same analysis to Turkey as well. Having said that, just like you explained, experiences that I had seeing the negative consequences of American action and American violence in the region, in my own backyard, that caused me to have a negative opinion about American hegemony in general, as opposed to the average person that grew up in the suburbs in the United States, where they never really question these things because they don't see it. They don't see the impact. They don't see the humanity of the people that are suffering. To them, it's nothing more than a group of people that probably deserve it. And at best, they are unfortunate collateral damage as a consequence of necessary violence that America has to dish out in this region. Mm. Experiencing like having these two different worldviews, coming from Turkey, then coming to the United States of America, I wanted to combat Western chauvinism to the best of my ability. That is probably the most polarizing aspect of my commentary for a lot of people. Because when I talk about healthcare, yeah, sure, there's a lot of Americans that still have this negative opinion about healthcare. They think, oh, that's socialism, that's communism. They've been conditioned to think that that's a bad thing. But I can make a pretty convincing case to the average American about why it's a necessity that we have to, abolish the private healthcare structure that exists in the country and replace it with a government-funded program that all these other
universal healthcare,
universal healthcare that all these other OECD nations have. But when I start talking about American militarism, when I start talking about American military adventure,
why do you think that's a red line, though? Not a red line in the real sense, but a red line in people's minds where it's like, I'll agree with you in all these different topics. But when it comes to American militarism,
yeah,
that's something I can't cross.
It's social conditioning. It's propaganda. You are born and raised into this belief that like the American military is good and its impact around the world is good. And even if it's bad, it's actually at the behest of in service of a larger good cause in general. There's that element of it. And then there's also the element of selfishness where there's this fear of the unknown. What if Russia was the hegemonic superpower? That would be terrifying. Yeah. What if China was the hegemonic superpower? That would be terrifying. I would much rather have America be the world police than China be the world police. There is this very real fear that I see in many Americans.
And the idea of like, we'd rather be the best of the worst.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, I think, part of the reason why a lot of people they get very offended when I come out and criticize American military action. And that's why the most common counter that I hear from many naysayers, even liberals themselves, who have become increasingly more militaristic in the last 20 years or so in the post-global war on terror environment that we're in, is the idea that my criticisms are just America bad, that there's not a lot of thought or effort put into it. And that's really ridiculous because I don't just say America bad because I hate America. I say American actions are bad because they are bad. they cause a lot of harm. I'm not committed to this idea that America is doing all of this violence in the region for a broader utilitarian purpose. I don't believe that at all. I think it's for pure extraction of natural resources. It's pure imperialism, which is, as Vladimir Lenin says, correctly, in my opinion, the final stage of capitalism. Imperialism is a necessity under capitalism when profit rates have a tendency to decline and these guys are seeking out new profit markets, new profit centers, and they inevitably cause the global South and the developing nations to suffer, because those are the new markets that you can always manipulate, destabilize, and create new labor markets and extract natural resources for pennies on the dollar from, to drive home imperial super profits from the global South. That's the reason why they do it.
Yeah, I was wondering if you're going to pull out a Lenin quote. Well, let me ask you this. Let me ask you the question that always gets a lot of engagement on YouTube, that people always stick on different videos. Do you believe that the U.S. is an empire in decline?
Yes, I do. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the violence is going to end. I think a lot of people misunderstand this concept. I do think that the United States is an empire in decline, and it's been apparent to me, I think, since, contrary to Fukuyama's initial assessment, the end of history, that was, I think, the beginning of the empire's decline, because they no longer had a polar opposite superpower that they were combating against. The dissolution of the USSR was disastrous for the Eastern Bloc. That much we all know, right? Hyper-exploitation, child prostitution, child trafficking, mass suicides taking place all around the former Soviet nations in the Eastern Bloc. But outside of that, I think it was a disaster for the West as well, because when Western finance capital no longer had any competition, or Western finance capital-backed countries no longer had any sort of ideological competition, they realized that they could just continue extracting profits in ways that made it worse for the domestic labor class. And that's the reason why capitalism went into overdrive. It was supercharged capitalism. And that's the reason why I think you see so much poverty in the West now. And you see this rot, this decline that many people actually recognize themselves now more than ever before. And that is because in the absence of competition, our capital-owning class have decided they can start extracting super profits from the domestic front as well.
Yeah. But, you know, there's also the argument that the U.S. government actually recognizes this, and that is why it's pursuing this Western, I guess, isolationist kind of not just rhetoric, but also politics and actions. And
yes,
in the sense of like what happened in Venezuela with Maduro, in the sense of what's happening right now with Greenland, that there is actually a sense that the U.S. recognizes this decline.
Yes,
and it's kind of safeguarding its way out of it.
In the most reductive ways to describe it, I think there's two different schools of thought right now. Mm. There is the global liberal hegemonic order that the Democrats are still trying to go back to at a moment of crisis for liberalism. I think liberalism is failing once again, just as it did 100 years ago. And fascism is the natural continuation of capitalism. You can either have liberal capitalism or you can have fascist capitalism. Fascism is what restores stability for capital owners, as it did historically in Nazi Germany and in Mussolini's Italy as well.
So are you saying this is where the U.S. is headed?
And I think that is precisely what the Trump administration is doing. In its inception, fascism was seen as a revolutionary movement, or it was presented as a revolutionary movement, a change from the liberal hegemony. Now, I think we in the post-World War II design, liberalism was the new world order. And now that it's in crisis, now that it's actually failing, there's a lot of instability, both in the domestic front and instability that it's caused all around the globe. And I think this more restrained version, I wouldn't necessarily say it's restrained, however, I guess the proper term would be this scaled back, hardened position in our hemisphere, in the way that, you know, Donald Trump and his allies presented, is actually a preparation for a multipolar world where the Western Hemisphere, where America will maintain its hegemony, will be a fascist design. It's an evolution away from liberalism. It is their version of post-liberalism. And unfortunately, on the left flank, due to tremendous amounts of resistance from liberals in general, the opposition, the Red Scare, the McCarthyist trials, and the leaning into reactionary movements in an effort to destroy what remains of labor militancy in the Western world, there is no post-liberal left flank position. There is no robust socialist, communist, trade unionist movement to oppose the growing wave of fascism that's taking over many liberal democracies of the West.
Just to, you know, for those who will push back against you and be like, okay, well, I guess the dominant trait of fascism is to be, you know, one party rule or authoritarianism, and mm-hmm. the U.S. isn't there yet. In terms of that argument, I'm saying,
yeah.
How would you push back?
So there's a couple different ways of looking at this, but I do think that America is a bourgeois democracy, and many Western liberal capitalist nations bourgeois democracy means that it's a two-party system. There's a duopoly, but both parties actually represent the interests of capital owners. And there's plenty of consensus politics that doesn't get addressed at all. Sure, there's differences between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party and their output and the things that they push for. There's a lot of culture war narratives that go around that try to make it seem as though these two parties have differences in opinion and how we must move forward. And those marginal differences actually are pretty impactful for the average person. And yes, one party is technically closer to my worldview than the other. But what gets lost in that conversation is the consensus between both parties that healthcare must be privatized. Sure, maybe right. Republicans want to deregulate it further than Democrats do, right. but ultimately there is no real opposition to the notion that healthcare must remain privatized, right? And any sort of left flank position from the likes of Bernie Sanders is met with a lot of anger and resentment, even from the Democrats as well, for having any sort of position that says this is unconscionable, this is immoral. We have to abolish private health care. This is met with a lot of resistance from liberal media and also Democrats in general. So that's one area of consensus. And it's a pretty big area of consensus. Another area of consensus politics between liberals and Republicans, or Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives, is about maintaining American hegemony around the globe, whether it be advancing NATO's interests, which I consider to be a protection racket, or whether it be, you know, doing the global war on terror, continuing to fund Israel's genocide. There is a consensus amongst our political class on this. And people that resist against that consensus are seen as outsiders. They're cast aside and they're either ritualistically humiliated, deplatformed, or pushed away, right, through pressure campaigns. So this is what I mean when I say there is a de facto one-party structure in the United States of America as well on a lot of the issues that pertain to material realities, the issues that are actually the bread and butter issues, the way to move forward. Like another consensus reality position is the housing market. It's not even a conversation that takes place in the United States of America to actually move towards social housing, for example. That's a non-starter. Nobody even advocates for it, even on the left flank position. Bernie Sanders doesn't even advocate for that, right? This is seen as like pure radical nonsense, right? Real communism. So unfortunately, that's the reason why I think that the American duopoly is also a one-party structure when it comes down to issues that pertain to material realities. And therefore, now there is this new evolution from within this one-party structure where the reactionary right is actually pulling away and changing their attitude about liberal democracy in general, noticing that liberalism is in crisis, liberalism is failing, and trying to reassert some kind of stability with dominance politics that fascism represents. Mm.
You know, another thing, Hassan, as I'm listening to you and speaking of liberalism and liberals, I can see why, again, you're in another unique position, because obviously, as you would expect, someone like you on the left, you're going to get hit hard from the right, right? The right, the center right and the far right, as you have it. But you also get knocked by liberals.
I do.
And I can see why, based on what you were saying. But it is a, I guess, a unique or interesting, whatever word you want to say, position to be in. But what, you know, getting knocked by liberals and the right, you know, what's that like?
It's expected, unfortunately.
It's expected?
I think that there's a separation between self-identifying liberals that are voters, like regular folk, ordinary folk that think that they're liberals, that I think can be convinced to recognize that socialism isn't so scary. But then there's also the party apparatus. If we're talking about the Democratic Party and its operatives, I mean, there are plenty of people that work in these campaigns that are big fans of mine that would, you know, openly say that they're radical in private, but still work to continue the system in meaningful ways because they want to make money. But as far as the politicians go, I think that, or as far as like the consultant class within the liberal first line of defense, yes, there is a lot of resentment towards my worldview. These are very well-educated people who want to maintain liberalism as its hegemonic status. They've learned about this in school. This is what they've this is what they've dedicated their lives into doing. So they have this severe inability to recognize that liberalism is in crisis, or even when they do kind of understand that liberalism is in crisis, they still have this failed notion, this false notion that they can return to the old way of doing business, that Trump is simply an aberration and not a continuation of capitalism and the defense of capitalism. I think that's dangerous, but it's understandable as to why they would grow resentful towards someone like myself. It's no different than the way that a lot of Democratic Party politicians, establishment Democrats, despise Bernie Sanders. Even though I'm far more radical than Bernie is, I would say that.
But just on that note, Hassan. Just on that note, if these guys, if these liberals are knocking you, whether in the Democratic Party or outside of it, then why are there reports of the Democrats trying to court you?
Because, like I said, I think they understand that I'm still under the... because I represent a lot of people.
They think you're still under the umbrella.
Yeah, and they see me as someone who they have to play ball with because, once again, not only do I have a fairly large audience, if not the largest audience of leftists in North America, they recognize that there's a base of activists within the party. Whether it be the DSA, PSL, or door knockers, people who are invested in climate justice, people who are invested in labor organizing, that they have to court these voters to a certain degree. And that's the reason why they sometimes feel the need to play ball with someone like myself, even if they never listen to the warnings.
In that context?
Play ball is in, offering me access, making it seem as though we are in line with one another. To the best of their ability so that, people from my audience will still end up turning around and voting Democrat. That's what it is.
And how do you react
to that? It's an extension of the harm reduction narrative that they try to present by, coming to my community and saying, you guys care about this stuff. You guys care about abortion. Of course we do. You care about queer rights. Of course we do. We're better than the Republicans on those issues. And that's true. I still try to use every opportunity to explain to Democrats that that's not enough and that that's not going to get the people that are not in my audience to go out and vote for you and that they have to change their trajectory. They have to change course on the way that they on the party platform in general. But it falls on deaf ears usually.
But how do you react to that? Just the playing ball aspect. Like, do you check the ball back or how do you react?
I do. Yeah. I mean, I've had plenty of conversations with people like Ro Khanna at the DNC and numerous politicians, both privately and also in public, on my stream, where I try to communicate them that their platform is a failure overall, that their platform is not actually reaching to enough people. Their platform is not effective in bringing people on board to vote for the Democratic Party. And, sometimes they listen. I mean, the conversations that I've had with Ro Khanna at the DNC versus the conversation I've had with Ro Khanna a couple of months ago at my house after his efforts succeeded in revealing a lot of these Epstein files alongside Congressman Tom Massey are night and day. I mean, the major difference is like he basically is now repeating the same things that I was telling him back then and championing these causes. So I think there are some people who are invested in making changes, whether those are aesthetic changes or real changes. Well, that remains to be seen.
So what should we be making of the media framing of this whole thing of you being the left's Joe Rogan? You know, there was this constant phrase, I know, but just to bring it back to viewers, is that after Trump won, there was this whole media round of like, you know, the Democrats need a Joe Rogan, the left needs a Joe Rogan. And then all of a sudden, all these media reports were pointing to you and you were doing all, you know, different rounds of interviews and stuff. But I know that you get asked it a lot, and I'm not even trying to get hit a cliche here. I'm actually trying to understand what do we need to make of this framing?
I mean, I take it because it's Joe Rogan is, you know, someone who I don't agree with at all. But he is a very popular person. So I'll take it as a compliment, right? I try to take that as a compliment when they bring this up. But another thing that I consistently stress is that, you know, and I kept repeating this over and over again in those exact same interviews that I was giving when they were like looking for a Joe Rogan of the left and saying, I'm the Joe Rogan of the left, is that you can't podcast your way out of this problem, right? Boom. There is a messaging gap between the Democrats and the Republicans. That's true. Republicans have invested quite a bit of time, quite a bit of money into independent media circles for many, many years. Having said that, however, you know, having a bunch of independent content creators that are lapping up and repeating the Democratic Party platform is not actually going to make up make up for the discontent that people feel. And we're seeing that right now. Democrats are the opposition party, but unfortunately, they come across as the controlled opposition party for many Americans, and that's the reason why they're very stressed about the feckless nature of the Democratic Party, and that's the reason why the Democratic Party's approval rating is underwater right now. That they should be automatically, as the only other alternative, the popular party in this country. They're not. As a matter of fact, I believe the Republicans at least still have a base of support and therefore are more popular than the Democrats are. Isn't that crazy? Mm. Trump has experienced historic lows in his approval ratings, and yet the Democrats are still an unimaginably unpopular party.
Why do you think that is? Like, what's your prescription? Is it because they're not hitting strongly enough on things on the domestic level, like ICE, for example, or they're not hitting stuff on the foreign policy level, like Israel and Gaza? Like, what do you
all
think it is?
All of it. People are not stupid. They see what's going on. They have the capacity to understand right from wrong. They also experience this hurt in their real lives.
Hurt.
Yeah, they do. They experience financial struggles. They recognize that Trump is not offering a solution to it. And the Democrats are not taking advantage of this crisis to say, no, we do have the appropriate measures. We do present a real alternative from the way that Donald Trump has presented his agenda. They are not doing that. They rarely fight. And for the first year of the Trump administration, when Trump was basically breaking the system piece by piece, even though there is a method to his madness, he was seemingly doing all he was seemingly bringing about so much chaos and not really taking advantage of his mandate that was also overemphasized. But that's besides the point. And trying to fix the financial issues that Americans were experiencing. Mm. The Democrats didn't do anything. They didn't push back at all. They briefly showed a backbone in the government shutdown conversation. And then, very famously, they caved when they had maximum leverage, when they had the public backing. They caved for no reason. Same thing with ICE. Same thing with the ICE funding. There was already $170 billion that were going into funding the Department of Homeland Security, making ICE the most well-equipped and well-funded federal law enforcement agency at a time when the Trump administration was using ICE as his own personal Gestapo force. You know, these mass people violating the Constitution, kidnapping our neighbors. A lot of people were very frustrated
by that.
This
is an important point because ICE is under the executive branch.
Yes.
I think sometimes people miss that point.
Yeah. Yeah. Using this unlawful domestic police force as a military occupation in blue cities. And the Democrats have not done a
but is that how
job
you
pushing
see
back against that.
As an occupation?
I do see it as an occupation, yes.
Let me actually ask you about that. This opens up an interesting point. Speaking of Minneapolis, or speaking of ICE and Minneapolis, you went to Minneapolis recently.
I did, yeah.
Yeah. Now, the whole thing about occupation that you're talking about, it's come up, I guess, in the media recently, although from two different camps. And I want to get your take on it. There was a take comparing, ICE to the Israeli army, the Israeli forces.
I've been doing quite a bit of that.
You've been doing quite a bit of that. Others have been, Palestinians have been doing quite a bit of that in different op-eds that I've read.
Yeah. I call it United States of Israel or Amer Israeli Years of Lead.
Well, I'm obviously we see where you stand on it.
Yeah.
But I was trying to say, what were you thinking of also the other camp? Where obviously you saw the Thomas Friedman New York Times piece and others.
Psycho.
You know, putting it on the other side, basically.
I would give me a crumb of power. I'm putting that man in prison.
Because what was the name of the headline? It was like Minneapolis and Gaza share the same violent language or something along those
lines.
Yes,
it was very interesting that while the comparison is so obvious and cliche at this point, in my opinion, if you're even, you know, remotely sentient as a fucking human being, Thomas Friedman had the audacity to compare the masked ICE agents to the Palestinian resistance. And from his perspective, it was the Palestinian resistance that was the danger and not the occupational force of Israel, because he's a psychopath. Many people, I don't think, agreed with that assessment. But I will say I received a lot of backlash towards my commentary on this, comparing the...
Why is that, Hassan?
Well, because I think a lot of people love Israel and want to defend Israel and care almost exclusively about defending the sanctity of Israel. And
so you're saying that
there are a lot of liberals who are doing that.
So the backlash was people who were, I guess, in favor of Israel, in the pro-Israel camp?
Okay. Yes. There was a lot of that from the liberal side, who are Israel first Democrats, who were very frustrated. And they were like, why are you bringing Israel into this? Well, part of the reason why I'm bringing Israel into it is because there are a lot of similarities with the occupational forces in Israel, in the West Bank occupation, the constant force projection that Palestinians are subjected to, the masked criminals that are kidnapping people from the street in the exact same ways that ICE is, and also the unlimited violence and lack of accountability. These are identical comparisons. The other reason why I was doing it is because Israel is a very unpopular entity now. So I was using not only the similarities, but to also remind people that, you know, ICE is an unpopular force in the same way that the Israeli occupational forces are. And the last reason why I was bringing it up is because ICE does use Israeli surveillance technology. ICE does get training in Israel and IDF, IOF training.
Why don't people talk about that? I feel like this is a misspoint.
Responsible
a lot of
Statecraft
time.
Actually did a comprehensive report on this, but there's a reason.
But that's the thing. It's not widespread. People don't talk about the fact that U.S. forces train with Israeli forces.
Yeah, the reason why they don't talk about it is because it's still regarded as a third rail that is untouchable in American media. That's the reason why they don't talk about it. And that's the reason why they get very offended when you bring it up. And they try to make you seem like you're a crazy person for bringing this up. Like, why do you care about Israel so much? It's a small nation. It's like...
Or conspiracy theorists or whatever.
Well, because it's not a conspiracy theory and it is real life. And many people are aware of it now. And not only is it real life, but also... Israel is an extension of American empire. Israel is not a separate entity from the United States of America, no matter how much either camp tries to present it as the case. Israel cannot do anything without American support. They can't defend themselves. They can't be as violent as they want to without unlimited support from American empire. There's a reason for why Israel is this malignant force in the region, this violent entity in the region, a constant destabilizing force in the region. And that is because it corresponds to the American grand design in this resource-rich region. Israel is a attack dog for American empire here. And that's the real reason why we say jump and Israel says how high, even though at certain times it does kind of feel like Israel is controlling the reins of American destabilization in the region.
Let me stop you right here because I want to highlight the backlash and the scrutiny. Obviously, everything you're saying right now gets you the scrutiny you get, but there's a difference between someone coming on and being like, Hassan, you're a shitty streamer, for example. I don't like your content. You're a shitty streamer.
Yeah.
There's a difference between that kind of backlash, let's say.
Yeah.
And then having politicians like Richie Torres, for example, or the ADL, or different media outlets accuse you of being a poster boy for anti-Semitism,
mm-hmm,
because of what you say on your stream and other outlets.
Yeah, they are trying to and sometimes succeeding in, but usually failing to deplatform me. That is the major goal here, because there is no reasonable discussion to be had here. Most people recognize right from wrong. They understand that Israel is a horrible ethno-nationalist fascist country that is doing a genocide and doing an apartheid on a good day when it's not doing a genocide. And these are unconscionable things that we've learned to oppose. We've learned to oppose this because we've been taught in liberal countries that we must be humanitarians. We must oppose genocide unconditionally. And that obviously makes it very difficult to defend Israel. So if Israel's actions are indefensible, then what do? Well, you try to silence people that are saying it's indefensible. And that's precisely the reason why they actively try to deplatform me. But even if I am deplatformed, I think the truth will still prevail. As this was a rallying cry for Palestinians for many, many years, demanding that, or hoping, sometimes begging that people actually pay attention to the atrocities that Israel was unleashing upon them. And post-October 7 landscape, we actually did see a lot more Western eyeballs on these atrocities, and a lot of people waking up to the reality of Israel as a malignant force of evil in this region.
Speaking of deplatforming, I guess what did your... You had like what, a 3-day, 4-day ban on Twitch?
Yeah, it was supposed to be a 7-day ban. They cut it down to 3.
What did that change your mind on Amazon at all? Amazon owns Twitch.
Yeah, I'm pro-Israel now. I'm Israel Chai. That's what I said. I was like, I do 10 Hail Marys and 10 Am Israel Chais every morning before I go live.
Threw me off guard. Yeah. My God, what was my question?
Yeah. I think it's the most moral nation in the world. And,
get out of here.
And they should take pieces of Saudi Arabia and Egypt, honestly. Take back the Sinai, you know, control the Red Sea. That's my take now. You got me.
My question.
Yeah.
I guess, did it change your mind in the sense of how you see Amazon? I mean, I don't know how exactly you were viewing Amazon before in terms of like just it as being a big tech company or whatever. But yeah. Like, look, the whole thing I'm getting at here is what happens next when, I guess, political restriction continues and, you know, you're just unable to carry out your, I guess, filming your content and doing that stuff. I mean, yeah, it was a 3-day ban here, but yeah, nothing says that it couldn't happen again or couldn't be longer or whatever. So political restriction is tightening, isn't it?
Yes, it is, for sure. There's an environment of censorship. I mean, we saw this with the TikTok forcible sale to a pro-Israel billionaire with the express purpose of making the platform pro-Israel. It doesn't get mentioned in the media once again, and it's very frustrating that it doesn't get mentioned in the media, but that is the express purpose as to why they wanted to initially ban TikTok and then force its sale to the Ellisons. And we're seeing that censorship already take place on TikTok, but that's not going to change people's attitudes about Israel. I think the cat's out of the bag at this point. So they are running on borrowed time. Having said that, you know, the way I see it is it's simple. This is just a hurdle I will have to overcome. If they ban me on Twitch, I go to YouTube. If they ban me on YouTube, I find a different platform. If they ban me from all those platforms, I'll get on a soapbox and I'll do rallies if I have to. But I have this firm commitment to the truth, and I also believe that truth and justice will prevail because I think that deep down inside, human beings are empathetic individuals. And they're constantly being inundated with a sea of fake information, deflections, diversions, and social conditioning that tells them that their first position that is empathetic to those who are vulnerable, who are marginalized, who are being killed, are actually good people that don't deserve this. I think that human need is what will always drive the progressive force of justice, and that history will vindicate us in the end of the day.
Yeah, but you're very aware that you could lose all of this, basically.
Yeah, I am.
And you're okay with it. You've come to terms with it.
well, there's not really much I can do about it, right? I just work within the confines of permissibility to the best of my ability. If I need to use coded language, I'll use coded language. If I get, like I said, if I get deplatformed, I'll continue pushing in different ways, but I won't stop. And I don't think we can stop, because it's not even just about caring about Palestinians. It's also self-interested as well. Palestinians are basically the first line of defense against these malignant forces of fascism around the world. I don't want to see all of that loss be in vain. I don't want to stop and leave Palestinians behind in the dustbin of history and continue on with my life. Because I do also recognize, even from a purely self-interested position, that the violence that we see over there inevitably comes back to the domestic home front, the imperial boomerang. And that's exactly the reason why I tie back to, Israel's violence back to the ICE occupation that we're experiencing here in the United States of America.
How has the coverage of Gaza, the Gaza genocide, changed you?
I don't know if it's changed me necessarily.
Has it not?
When
I say changed you,
I've been an anti-Zionist far before October 7th.
Not in the sense that you're a different man. It's more of just like, has it changed the way you look at things? Has it changed the way you look at the world? Has it changed the way you look at America or, you know, the Western world, I should say?
I didn't really have a very positive opinion of Western hegemony to begin with.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. No, fair.
So in that regard, it's just only hardened my position.
There's that talking point that the mask has been dropped.
The mask has been dropped, and that has made it easier for me to convince people, I think. Because back in the day, people would still say, oh, well, this is still for good, right? Like, come on. But genocide is black and white. Therefore, it's maybe hardened the camp of Zionists and maybe even pushed liberal Zionists to become ultra-Zionists. But that is a much smaller group of people than the people who just carried on with their day without ever really thinking about Israel, without knowing anything that Israel was doing. And the large majorities of the population in the Western world as well have woken up to the reality of Israel's violence.
Okay, let me ask you the question a different way. Do you feel like it's changed maybe the way your audience sees things?
Oh, absolutely.
Your coverage of the genocide.
Absolutely. I think that...
There we go. We're on to something.
Yeah. So in the immediate aftermath of October 7, I think a lot of people were not ready for someone to say that Israel was responsible in a very meaningful way for the violence that unfolded on October 7.
You said this last night at the Web Summit.
Yeah. And the Jewish Insider newspaper hated it. They were saying this dangerous radical is blaming Israel for October 7. Yeah, many people did, including Haaretz, its editorial board, on October 9, 2023, when they said, we have to take a cold, hard look at the Israeli security needs and how that has unfolded in unlimited violence towards the Palestinians, who see no other way out of this other than fighting back. And there is truth to that. And that is the reality, right? I think many people in the Western world were not ready for it. They were just either completely oblivious to the ways in which the Israeli apartheid worked. They were completely oblivious to the violence that Israel dished out to the people of Gaza over and over again, the people in the West Bank over and over again. There was a lot of backlash. A lot of people said, this is not for me. You are, I've agreed with you up until this point, but I think it's unconscionable to continue supporting you. They left. I received wave after wave of attacks calling me a dangerous anti-Semitic terrorist. I just kept pushing regardless.
How do you keep pushing through that?
Because these aren't
just light things to be said about someone.
Because it's the truth.
These aren't light labels.
Because I'm right. Because Palestinians deserve someone to platform their voices.
Did you never feel like maybe I need to take a step back?
There were moments where I thought maybe I'll quit and go back to, go back to college, get a PhD, go into the realms of academia. But I'm glad I didn't pursue that because it did feel somewhat lonely, I will admit. But again, I'm in a position of profound privilege, right? So What kept me going through it is like, I mean, what is this? I live in a nice house. I don't have to worry about my family members being killed. There aren't drones overhead. The Palestinian reporters that I was talking to in Gaza, some of which were killed by Israel. These people, they were experiencing tremendous pain, death and destruction. They were experiencing a genocide. So for me, it's the least I could do. You know, who cares? Who cares about, you know, losing a large chunk of your audience and having people call you a terrorist is nothing. It, as long as I can continue having a platform, albeit a diminished one, you know, I'm going to keep pushing through it. And there were plenty of people who also suffered more than I did in the Western world as well. You know, people that lost their jobs, people that were imprisoned, people that were threatened with deportation, people that are still going through these processes like Mahmoud Khalil. And, you know, we do it because it's right. We do it regardless of the penalties, not because we're going to receive something in return, but we do it because it's the correct thing to do. We do it because we want to make sure that these Palestinian deaths were not in vain. And we do it so that we can stop the further pain the Palestinians are experiencing.
On the personal level, is there any particular thing that you fear about yourself or your loved ones? Because of the work that you're doing, like, yeah, in connection, I mean, to what we just
there
said.
There is a constant environment of fear more than ever before that this administration, unlike previous administrations, are way more open about their desire to punish naysayers, their desire to punish people.
You got detained at one point, right?
Yeah,
when
I did.
You were coming in from a flight or something.
Yeah, I was coming in. I was coming back in from France at Chicago O'Hare Airport, where Customs and Border Patrol detained me.
Right.
And they asked me incredible questions. My opinion on Donald Trump, my opinion on Israel, whether or not I've ever corresponded with a member of Hamas or Ansar Allah or Hezbollah. Now, what was interesting about that is that talking to a member of Hamas or Hezbollah or Ansar Allah is not illegal. It's actually constitutionally protected. I can do that as an American citizen, and I can certainly do that as an American citizen in the media, right, as a member of the press. And yet, this was being presented as though it was an actionable item, as though it was, you know, something that they could pursue with prosecution in direct violation of the First Amendment. And yet they were still doing it. And I think the reason why they were doing it was to create a chilling effect on free speech. That didn't stop me from continuing my advocacy.
Could it get worse?
But I think, you know, we do live in a different environment now where the administration has demonstrated over and over again that they don't care about the First Amendment at all, that they will not protect it. And the Constitution is utterly meaningless if people are not bought into protecting it at the end of the day. And we've seen over and over again that this there's a pliant Supreme Court that will do everything to advance Donald Trump's agenda. You know, one of the latest examples of this is what happened with Don Lemon. Now, Don Lemon and I don't see the world. We're not in the same ways. Where Don Lemon and I, I wouldn't say, are ideologically aligned with one another on many issues. Having said that, I will fight for his right to continue doing advocacy and continuing to operate in the capacity as independent press.
Do you see the Don Lemon, I guess, fiasco and everything that happened with it, do you see that as some sort of turning point, or is it just a moment?
I don't know if that's a turning point necessarily. I think I think it's just another expansion of the right. The permission structure that exists, right? The administration is not shy about seeing what they can get away with, and I think right now they're exhausting the courts to see if the courts will still hold, to see if the courts will still maintain protection of the constitutional rights that every American citizen has. But it's entirely in the hands of the last line of defense of what remains of theoretical American democracy, and that is the court system.
You mentioned the Ellisons like a few minutes ago, and I told you I was going to come back to CBS. So the Ellisons own Paramount, Paramount own CBS. Barry Wise is the editor-in-chief of CBS. Does Barry Wise being the editor-in-chief of CBS make your job easier?
It does a little bit, because she is so repulsive and so incompetent that I'd rather have an incompetent operative be the face of Zionism in mainstream media than a competent one.
This particular move, her being appointed, it is a turning point, going back to that word.
Oh, for sure.
But let's actually unpack why it is. Like, what is the significance of that?
I mean, there is a very obvious attempt to take out one of these institutional legacy publishers and turn it into a pro-Trump, pro-Israel propaganda machine. They're using what remains of CBS's credibility amongst the aging population to get like, get a couple shots in to try to convince like 75-year-olds that like Israel is actually a force for good to the best of their ability. I think it's going to inevitably lead to failure. It already has led to many different catastrophic incidents, but I don't think that is consequential for Barry Weiss's career and future in the media, because her job is to do this unconditionally. Her job is to put forward people, not because she will make CBS a popular news outlet. That's not her job at all. Her job is to just take advantage of CBS's existing credibility as an objective news machine and use that remaining objectivity, that remaining veneer of credibility, to do a couple shots of pro-Israeli and pro-Trump propaganda.
So where does the media go from here in your point of view?
I don't know, because...
Like, do you see this being repeated across networks, perhaps?
Maybe. I think CNN is probably next. We'll see where that goes as well. But I also think that there is this larger problem for legacy publishers in general, where they have an aging population, and people under a certain age are just not tuning in to CNN or CBS at all anymore. There's a crisis of credibility in mainstream news as well, that certainly accelerated with their coverage on Gaza. Mm-hmm. The reality is that's not a problem that you can really solve. I don't think that's a problem you can solve with like offering fresh perspectives. I mean, you could probably try to change the coverage a little bit to make it more interesting for a younger audience. I don't think Barry Weiss is going to be able to find success there, but that would go against the overall interests of the capital owners that own these media outlets. Like, they want to continue putting out propaganda that defends the interests of capital, that continue defending the American State Department's position. And I think the audiences want something different. So
audiences want something different. So yeah. Do you think that what you do as a streamer, is that, I guess, is it the present or is it the future of news consumption?
Well, kind of feels like it might be the future of news consumption, considering the numbers that I have in these demographics that they're trying to desperately reach, especially considering how much larger my audience is in comparison to CNN and Fox News, especially in the 18 to 35 demo. It probably does mean it's the future of media.
But you call yourself an entertainer. You don't call yourself a journalist.
Yeah.
But if you're going on that trajectory, why not call yourself? Because at face value, let's say you coming here and being like, no, actually, I'm an entertainer. Maybe to others, it might look like you're trying to evade some sort of responsibility, where you're like, if I call myself a journalist, then you're holding me to a particular standard. And yet you're here saying that you've got a bigger audience than CNN or other networks.
Yeah, I do hold myself to journalistic standards. I would say in ways that maybe some of these institutional media outlets don't any longer. I do engage in adversarial reporting as well. But the reason why I say I'm an entertainer or a political commentator is because I do have the capacity and do sometimes engage in reporting and do journalism, but I don't think it's appropriate to say I am a journalist, because I feel like that's a totally separate function. I do rely heavily on journalism, though, and journalists that are doing real reporting in different newsrooms, also in mainstream media as well, and independent journalism as well. I think DropSite and Zatteo are alternatives in this new media environment.
Come on, man. Let's throw MEE in there.
Yeah. Okay. Middle East. Yeah. Sure. MEE is another example of this as well. But what I do already exists in mainstream news, right? I mean, I see myself as someone who is doing what Jake Tapper is doing, right? Jake Tapper might call himself a journalist, but he doesn't do a lot of journalism. What kind of real journalism is he doing, right? He's just doing commentary. I do the same thing.
But that's a prevalent method. Like, that's a prevalent format for American media in general, commentary.
Yeah, exactly. It's the most prevalent format now. Yeah. And I think that, I mean, we can have a larger conversation about what that means for political education in this country. Do I think that that's a good thing in general? Not necessarily. But even in the past, I think when news reporting was very straightforward and there wasn't a lot of color commentary on top of it, you know, in the pre-Fox News media landscape, there was still the capacity for mainstream press to oftentimes lead people astray or to keep them to shy away from doing objective news reporting on issues that did not correspond to the American State Department line. You know, there's a reason why there's this massive generational gap between those who have a positive position on Israel versus those who have a negative position on Israel. That is because for in the last 80 years, for the most part, mainstream media had a very positive opinion on Israel, and that was their output in general. They rarely ever did negative coverage on Israel. And that's why entire generations that grew up on watching mainstream reporting on this issue were led astray, were propagandized against the truth on what Israel was actually doing to the Palestinians. So there is a positive outcome of this as well. I do recognize that. Like, I would not exist in the absence of independent news, in the absence of reporting taking place on the internet. So I am grateful for this new media environment, although I am also fearful of this new media environment, because not every single person has the same interest as I do in making sure that they seek truth from facts and engage in objective commentary to the best of their ability, or even reveal what their biases might be. I think that's more honest than making it seem as though there is a capacity to engage in objective news coverage without having your biases play a role. I think everyone is biased, and it's better for people to reveal their bias positions beforehand than to not do that and to make it seem as though they're apolitical or centrist or objective in their coverage.
I'm running out of time here, but I do want to throw a curveball before we wrap up. Why'd you stop doing Piers Morgan? Is it because he does your uncle dirty on these thumbnails? You know what I'm talking about. He's always
in the beginning. I was seeking out any outlet that would have me, so I could just slam as much of the Palestinian position as I possibly can.
The last time you were Piers Morgan, you told the guy to shut the fuck up.
I did, but I think it's a clown show for the most part. People like the dunks. People love my appearances on Piers Morgan. But the reason why I was doing it wasn't so that I could engage in this media circus. The reason why I was doing it is because I was desperate to get any outlet I possibly could, to reach any audience I possibly could with the pro-Palestinian position. And after a certain point, I felt like it was unproductive to engage in this back and forth where people were coming in just for the spectacle and not necessarily to learn. So once the media landscape started shifting and there were and people were more open-minded to the pro-Palestinian position, I just went back to my own community and kept doing my news coverage, because I felt silly to consistently have to deal with Zionists on the Piers Morgan show that may or may not be getting paid by the State of Israel to present this totally false narrative and totally ridiculous alternative reality. I didn't want to deal with that at all.
Listen, man, I want to keep going, but you got a busy schedule. You got a flight tonight as well. Hassan Piker, thank you for taking the time to come on Real Talk, man. I really enjoyed this.
Thank you for having me. This was wonderful.
Thank you, sir.